Land is central in the construction of identity for many communities. For Ute Native Americans, the meaning of a 12 million acre homeland in western Colorado is intricately linked to the various ways they understand their heritage and future. Brandy Dennison narrates the history of this community's removal, remembrance, and return to this land in the book Ute Land Religion in the American West, 1879-2009. She argues that discourses about religion were essential to settler colonialism in the American West. These took shape through justifications for the displacement of Utes, in civilizing missionary projects, imagined nostalgia about pre-contact Colorado, and as means for Ute to warrant inclusion and return. The category religion was deployed in a variety of ways by natives and white settlers in order to establish, deny, exclude, and restore communities within the region. In our conversation, we discuss the shift from notions of dirt to land, Ute engagement with the term religion, land and religious identity, Nathan Meeker and the 1879 conflict in the White River Valley, Ute removal, sexual purity, morality, and rape, Ute land religion in fiction and anthropology, the Meeker Massacre Pageant, the Smoking River Powwow, and attempts at reconciliation. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Religion. Without any further delay, here's my conversation with Brandy Dennison about Ute Land Religion in the American West, 1879-2009, published by the University of Nebraska Press in 2017. Welcome, Brandy. Thanks for joining us on New Books in Religion. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is an excellent book. I think anyone either focused on Native American traditions or the study of religion really needs to take a look at this book, Ute Land Religion in the American West. Before we hop into the book, though, it's always our custom here to learn about our authors and a little bit about how you came to the study of religion, what brought you to this particular subject matter, kind of what made you the scholar you are today.
All right, great. Well, I was born and raised in Western Colorado, and both sides of my family were farmers. And I grew up hearing stories about the Utes, kind of, but it wasn't really a central part of my understanding of Western Colorado, which leads into why I decided to write this particular book. But then I left Western Colorado because I just needed to get out of the dry culture and or just the dry landscape. And I went to Tacoma, Washington for an undergraduate degree at the University of Puget Sound because it was green. And that was really my only criteria. But in selecting a major, I really struggled with it, not because there wasn't anything interesting to me, but because everything was interesting to me. I liked my political science classes. I liked my literature classes. I liked my history classes. And I found myself gravitating to the religious studies department more and more simply because I felt like it was a really nice intersection of all of my interests. And so I was a religious studies major as an undergraduate, and then went to CU Boulder for a master's degree in religious studies. And while I was an undergraduate, I thought I was going to be a biblical archaeologist, which is a very different place from where I ended up. But I found myself that being more excited about the way readings about the way that history is used and the way that religion is used. I was reading a lot in cultural memory studies and realized that my interests were far more aligned with the modern period rather than the ancient past. And there I took a class with Michaeline Pazantaby, and that class was where I did my first research project on what later became the book. So it's been a really long process of getting there. And then after I completed that, I went to UNC Chapel Hill for a PhD in religious studies, where my dissertation advisor, Lori Mathley Kipp, really encouraged me to explore this project further. And really my main interest was in these two questions of why didn't I learn about the Utes as a Western Colorado native? Why didn't I have a better sense of my own place's history? And then this other question of there's this captivity narrative that came out of the removal of Utes, where an Indian woman, her name is, she's identified as Susan in the captivity narrative, is why is she being described as having a Christian disposition? Why is it that the only sort of goodness that could be ascribed to Indians has to be framed through a Christian lens? So those were the two main driving questions for me to propel me to write the book and stick with it for such a long period. And I think I've answered those two questions, at least for myself, through the process of writing the book. And hopefully those are interesting questions to other people, and other people can find them, the answers to those, useful.
Yeah, and you do this in a very well written and kind of measured way, and I think you are successful in kind of looking at the intersection of these various histories and how they're reimagined. So a lot of listeners might not be familiar with the kind of subject matter, even kind of the basics. So I'm wondering if you can kind of set us up with kind of a Utes 101 in a sense. What types of things do we need to understand about the Utes just to get into your project here?
Absolutely. So my project focuses on Western Colorado and Eastern Utah. But the Utes historically were a tribe that occupied the territory of present-day Colorado and then southern Wyoming, most of Utah, and then the northern parts of New Mexico. Pre-contact, that is before the Spanish arrived, they were predominantly a hunting and gathering culture. So they were also a bilateral kinship, which means that a person identified their ancestry through both their mother and their father. It's kind of unusual for indigenous tribes to be bilateral. They're generally matrilineal, which means they trace their lineage primarily through their mother. But the Utes are just sort of this unique little tribe, and that they have a lot of traditions that are very characteristic to them alone. And one thing that tied the Utes together as a group, they were really sort of loosely organized. There wasn't a really strong hierarchy. It was definitely democratic in the sense that if you didn't like what one leader was suggesting that the group do in terms of hunting, then you just go and find a different leader. And it wasn't very driven by violent leadership overthrows. Instead, it was just sort of this more fluid, loosely structured society. Also, the gender relationships were similarly balanced as well. By and large, men were the hunters, and by and large, women were the gatherers. But it wasn't a really strong division of labor. Women participated in hunts, and men participated in gathering. There are some tribes that are much more attached to the division of labor. The introduction of the horse, which happened with the Spanish, really radically changed their lifestyle. This happened in the roughly around the 1700s, and prior to this, the arrival of the Spanish had really changed the captivity system that existed in the Southwest. More broadly, the Indian groups in the Southwest did engage in captivity and adoption and raiding, where they would raid another group and capture people and then bring them into their tribe and generally adopt them. And sometimes the captives would be enslaved, but the slavery that that existed in this pre-contact time wasn't the same thing as chattel slavery, where you were born into it and you would die in it and you would never escape. Instead, often people that were captured, became slaves, then might actually end up being adopted into a family and be married and start having children that had equal status in the tribe. But those Spanish really started exploiting this system so that, especially for tribes that did not have access to the horse, they became victims of this more intensified system of captivity and slavery. So the Utes were enthusiastic adapters of the horse, because this meant then that they could be raiders rather than the people that are being captured. It also gave them much greater flexibility in terms of hunting. So it's much easier to hunt on horseback than it is on foot. And as a result, the men in particular began collecting as many horses as possible. And so horses became this status symbol. For the Utes in particular, it was more like people that acquire lots of cars and have extensive garages full of different types of cars, rather than other cultures where the horse was actually a sacred animal. For the Ute, the horse wasn't sacred, but it certainly was very important because it represented power and it represented freedom. By owning horses, that meant that most likely you wouldn't be captured.
Now, from a kind of theoretical standpoint, you tackle the category of religion and this idea that it's a second order category, the product of academic discourse. How would you describe Ute engagement with the term religion? Because I think this seems to be a large part of your argument. And then what does this Uteland religion, this phrase, what does it mean in your study?
So in the time that I've, since I've written the book and in conversation with my students, I've come to think about religion more as a designation of power than what I was talking. Like, it's sort of more of an outreach and thought and thinking and developing since I've written this book, that the term religion is very much wrapped up in who has the power in the society. And deeming something as being religious is deeming it as being something that's acceptable and part of the fabric of the culture. And so religion is very much, and from my perspective, is very much located within a Western colonial project that is a marker of settler colonialism. And when Utes are engaging with the term religion and religious, they're generally doing it in order to find a way to participate in the public that is linked to white imperialism, and therefore linked to these spaces where decisions get made. But many of the Utes that I interviewed, and then also in looking back at oral history interviews that were conducted in the 1970s, it really seems that they're in the 1970s, they're engaging in the idea that they're spiritual, not religious. And so there's a sense of rejecting of the term religion because it's too associated with Western imperialism. And this greater sense that what they are doing is beyond religion. And that idea of what the youth are doing is beyond religion is something that during different points in the 20th century, white allies of the youths really latch onto in order to sort of dip into youth religious practices or youth ceremonial practices as being the paragon of what real religion could be. So again, it's this discourse of rejecting religion that's associated with Western imperialism and institutions, and instead finding real spiritual and religious expression in these natural indigenous practices. And all of that, I think, is it's definitely a social construction that's based on the time and place. And so I through the book, I track how a variety of people, like anthropologists and then amateur anthropologists and outside observers, are engaging with this idea of what authentic religion is. And the youths are also engaging in that idea of authentic religion, but it's often for other means. It's for making sure that they can have access to hunting grounds, or it's making sure that they can continue to practice traditional dances, or it's trying to find access to U.S. presidents in order to argue for the restoration of treaty lands. I use the term land religion to talk about this collaborative space that's built around the sort of fragile idea of authentic religious experience and the idea that Utes have this authentic religious experience that whites can somehow participate in and have this sense of immersive religious experience, but is also this place where Utes are attempting to gain some sort of political or economic power.
Another key component here in the book that maybe we're jumping the gun a little bit in some of the details, but seems to be kind of a theme throughout, is this relationship between land and religion. So can you talk a little bit about the relationship between land use and religious identity, both for Ute subjects, but then also how land is understood by white settlers?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the arguments that I make in the book is that there's a movement from dirt to land in how whites in particular are engaging Ute spirituality. So with dirt, I was mainly focusing on Nathan Meeker, who was Indian agent that was the head of the Ute Indian Agency in what now is called Meeker, Colorado, where he was in charge of dispersing rations and also in charge of teaching the Utes how to become farmers. And his engagement with the land was really material. He was actually working with the dirt. He was plowing it. He was encouraging Ute men to also plow it. And it was this very sort of tangible thing. And when Meeker and other people were thinking about Indian relationships to land, it was through this very material, we need to make them farmers. And there's a link to it of we need to make them farmers because they are currently not religious. And of course, in this case, religion meant they're not Christian. Meeker has had multiple opportunities to observe religious, traditional religious ceremonies, but he never identified it as being religious. And then the movement to land is this idea of abstraction, that land is this very abstract idea in the white imagination that can represent the sense of purity, that if you're familiar with William Cronin's argument in The Trouble with Wilderness, William Cronin is an environmental historian. And in this essay, he's arguing that the idea of wilderness is very much wrapped up in ideas of purity, and that once a person arrives in the wilderness, it's no longer wild. And the same way with land, that once the white person arrives in land, it's no longer authentically land. It becomes the sort of tarnished urban environment, or at least an environment that's on its way to becoming urban. The same thing with the same thing that happens with Ute, ideas of Ute religion, that when we were thinking about when settler colonials were thinking about dirt in relationship to Ute religious practices, there was no Ute religious practice. But once we get into this idea of land, this abstract idea, then Ute religions are also this sort of abstract, pure idea of being authentically spiritual, authentically religious. And there's a lot of effort to preserve that without being touched by Christianity.
Now, Nathan Meeker, you mentioned him. He becomes this key figure in the early contact between white settlers and the Utes. Can you tell us a little bit more about him and then his role leading up to this this conflict in 1879?
Nathan Meeker is such an interesting person. I was able to, in the process of doing research for this book, able to read his diaries from when he was an idealistic 20-year-old in a very interesting time in American history. So he's in correspondence with Horace Bushnell. He's engaging in the ideas of the Transcendentalists. Early in his life, he participates in a phalanx, which was based on Charles Fourier, the French philosopher that was purporting the putting forward the idea that agricultural communities that are based in communism and gender equality would then bring about this perfect society. And so, his diaries at this time are just a really interesting catalog of what it would have been like to be an American during this time period who's interested in religious movements. He eventually decides that agriculture really is the means of salvation, that agriculture is going to save society, and it's going to save humanity altogether. And he's hired by Horace Greeley to be the agricultural editor at the newspaper. And in the process of doing this, he goes out to Colorado and finds a tract of land that he thinks would be a great place to try out the experiment of a society that's rooted in agriculture. And so Horace Greeley and Nathan Meeker set about collecting people to participate in this venture. And then that becomes Greeley, Colorado, which is about an hour north of Denver. And it doesn't fully work out. Like the first year, the trees that they planted die because they weren't able to get enough water. People are really upset because it's not work. They've left their nice home in New York, and here they are in the plains of Colorado, and their trees are dying, and they don't have any food, and they don't have their houses that they have been promised. And Greeley dies. Nathan Meeker is in debt to his estate, and so he just starts applying for every single job that is out there. It's just clearly desperation for him that he just wants any job. He applies for these ambassador positions. He applies for all sorts of government jobs, but the one that he gets is as Indian agent to this very remote area for Ute Indians in Colorado. And so he packs up his family and moves up to the mountains. And but he never really loses his idealism that he had in his 20s. His letters at this time are just like so hopeful that he is going to be the one that is going to make Ute men farmers. And he identifies the horse as being the main thing that is keeping the Utes from becoming farmers. And he was probably right. Ute men spent a lot of time training horses. They liked to race them and bet on them. And they preferred to use the pastures that are the land as pastures for the horse. And Nathan, of course, wanted that to be farmland. And this eventually escalates to the point where the Ute men are feel so terrorized by Nathan that they start to terrorize Nathan back. And so then Meeker calls for the cavalry to come, and the U.S. Army enters into Ute territory, which is a declaration of war. And they respond. And there are two separate battles. One, the Milk Creek battle, and then a second one, which I call the White River agency battle. And in that, Nathan Meeker is killed, as well as the other white agency men. A number of Ute men are killed, and Nathan's wife and daughter, and the wife of another agency employee that was also killed, are taken. The Utes take them captive.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the significances of them? What is the aftermath, I guess, of this kind of confrontation?
So one of the big things that came about is the question of what happened to the white women when they were held as captives by the Utes. They were in captivity for 29 days. And once they are released, then all through the newspapers, the line was that they did not suffer any of the indignities which the Bucks offered. Which, of course, is a euphemism for saying that they were not raped. And a central figure in the prevention of the rape of the white women was Susan. At least this emerges through the captivity narrative and then also earlier newspaper articles. However, Arvilla Meeker, who is Nathan Meeker's wife, writes a letter to the Pueblo Chieftain, which was the Pueblo newspaper at the time, asserting that, in fact, they had been raped and that they had been encouraged to lie, partially because of the fraught nature of being a rape victim in the 19th century, especially for her daughter, Josephine, and the other woman that was a captive who was only 16 years old at the time. So you had a 19-year-old woman and a 16-year-old woman who were both marriageable, but would not be marriageable if it was widely known that they had been raped by Ute men. And this narrative of that the white women were raped then becomes the impetus for Congress to act and to move forward quickly with the removal of all of the Utes from Western Colorado. There is an effort by the military to identify the men that specifically that had been charged with raping the women. And some of them were captured and taken to Fort Leavenworth, but it was also the entire tribe that was put on trial and that suffered a great loss of land as a result. Now, there's a lot of other things that are wrapped up into the removal of the Utes. They were on the entire half, western half of Colorado, which is a sizable piece of land. Near the Aspen area, they had ceded some territory because miners had located silver. And there was also an expectation that Western Colorado would be resource rich and that the Utes were underusing this land, and therefore they should be removed, and whites should have access to it. But all of this gets wrapped up into a rhetoric of morality that at their core, the Ute tribe is immoral, and that with their proximity to other white women, there is this chance for women and children to be in continued danger. Now, from the other side, there is... In Native American cultures, it's been widely documented that the accusations that Native men raped white women were definitely overstated. And I think that that is absolutely true. And there's also a oral history tradition among the Utes that the women, the white women, were not raped. I actually contend that both are equally possible and both could be true at the same time. We'll never know what actually happened in terms of whether or not the white women were raped. But in my book, I talk about the different ways of thinking about consent and the different cultural contexts for thinking about rape. Rape is very much... a term that developed in English legal culture that is about depriving white men of the property of and lineage of women, of white women. And so literature about rape often talks about how white men cannot rape, but men of color can rape. Because white men aren't, because it's taking away that reproductive right from white men. And then from the Ute perspective, they're operating within this wider system of captivity, of the Southwest captivity culture, where women would be captured and would be adopted into the tribe. And being adopted into a tribe generally meant that they would be married to one of the men in the tribe. And this doesn't mean that they consented to be married and they didn't consent to sexual contact, but it was within this framework of creating families and creating kinship. So it wasn't the same sort of idea of overpowering women through sex and through rape that then that woman becomes tainted and you don't like society doesn't want to have anything to do with her. Instead, sex could happen without consent within the Native tribe. But it was in the service of these webs of kinship. It's still uncomfortable to think about as not being rape because we are so sitting in the 21st century. We are, especially now with the Me Too movement, it's very easy to just think that any sex without consent is horrible and awful. And I would tend to agree with that, but we also have to think about the cultural conditions in which sexual relationships occur.
Kind of the counterpart of this negative production of Utes by white settlers, there's also kind of a construction of good Native women. And especially through two figures who you highlight, can you talk a little bit about how were Native women used in kind of the cultural memory? What did they come to represent in the context you're looking at?
Yeah, so Utes were removed from Colorado in 1881, and in that period of the 1880s, really up until the present time, the white settlers of Colorado moved quickly to sort of fill the absence of the region's past, their own past, with particular constructions of Indianness. And there are two Ute women in particular that get highlighted through this process. And that's Chipeta, who was the wife of Ouray, who is recognized by the U.S. government as the chief of the Utes, although not all Utes recognized him as chief for the reasons I mentioned at the beginning, that Utes are generally non-hierarchical and wouldn't recognize one chief over the entire tribe. But Chipeta was often highlighted as being a representation of the good Indian. And then the other one is Susan, who is understood to be Ouray's sister, although there's some haziness about and that relationship. So Susan was the Indian that in the captivity narrative steps in to prevent the Ute men from raping the white women. So she gets exalted frequently. There's also this backstory of Susan that emerges at the time of the Ute removal, of Susan herself being rescued from being nearly burned at the stake by the Cheyenne Indian tribe. And she's rescued by the army and taken in by an Indian agent and then restored to her family. The historical record does point to a woman, an Indian woman who was rescued from captivity from the Cheyenne and returned to her family, but the specific details of her being burned at the stake and also her being Susan was not corroborated in the historical record. After the fact, people start retelling that story with the name Susan as the Indian woman that is rescued. And then there's all sorts of narratives about, well, she was rescued, so then she wants to rescue the white women that develop out of that. Susan sort of falls out of cultural memory, and Chipeta becomes the person who is rescues the white women. And I think that that's partly because of their positions. With being a former chief's wife, Chipeta takes on this leadership role in her tribe that Susan did not. And she makes, once the tribe is removed, she makes trips to visit presidents in Colorado when they come. So one example is she visits President Taft, and there's this very striking image of her in a car driving down the streets of Montrose, Colorado, with President Taft. I suspect that the reason that she intentionally went to see Taft was because she was wanting to advocate for the return of land to her tribe, and also to ask for more money so that her tribe wouldn't be starving as they were at that time. But it was really sort of treated as like this homecoming of sorts, but not a real homecoming, but sort of this like, look, the Indians aren't mad at us because Chipeta's here, and isn't that great? And she's coming in peace, and she's not angry with us. Isn't that amazing? And it's this just sort of really tragic moment when it really seems like the two sides are completely talking past each other. But Chipeta gets memorialized in all sorts of ways. An image of her is in stained glass in the state capitol in Denver. There's novels written about her, and all of this sort of fictionalizing going around her story as this Indian woman who is protecting white women from Ute men.
Now, the ceremonial practices of Utes were memorialized and remembered by non-natives in particular ways, both in kind of fictional ways, but also in anthropological studies. Can you tell us how did religion come to be understood within these this kind of cultural remembrance of Ute spirituality?
Yeah, so the ceremonial dance that is particular to the Utes is the bear dance. And this is an annual gathering that pre-contact would have happened when spring is about to happen, like just before the, just as the bear is waking up from hibernation. And it would be the one time that all of the Utes would gather together in one place. Otherwise, they were spread out across that very big territory in smaller bands. And it was definitely a sacred time in that it was set apart from everyday time. It was also the time when new sexual relationships would be established. So women would decide to leave their current arrangement and engage in a new relationship. And divorce was a very sort of easy thing if both people agreed, or even if just one person agreed, whether it's a man or a woman, the relationship would be over. And the people would move on to a new one. And that often happened at the bear dance. When by the late 20th century or early 20th century, when American anthropologists are observing the bear dance, they see it as being not as sacred as the sun dance, which the Utes adopted around the 1890s. So about the time that they were moved on to reservations. And they got the Sundance from the Shoshone. So this is not a Lakota style Sundance with the body piercings. Instead, there isn't body piercings, but there is long periods of dancing around a sun pole. But the anthropologists really focused on the Sundance as being authentic expression of religion. And the bear dance was just a social thing. And so there is this work of distinguishing real religious experience as being something that can't be about sexual relationships, but instead is about attaining shamanistic visions, which is one of the goals of the Sundance. Even though the Sundance wasn't a pre-contact Ute religious tradition. And the other thing that is happening at this time is the introduction of peyote. And there are some Indians, Zeke Kalasa, who is a Lakota Indian who worked on the Ute Indian Agency in the 1910s and 1920s, was very much anti-peyote use. She saw it as being something that was destructive to the tribe, and was dulling the senses of the Indians. And she was arguing that peyote wasn't even a real Indian practice. It was just introduced by white railroad owners as a means to control the Indians. Now, that part's not actually true. It was introduced by Indians in association with a peyote ceremony. And but there was this also like interest in separating it out as being inauthentic. There were other anthropologists that were interested in the peyote ceremony, but were very interested in finding the peyote ceremony that did not have Christian influences. So again, there's this quest for something that's authentic, that is apart from Western influence. And I think that they were on a quest for something that didn't exist, because the peyote ceremony was very much developed in the time and place of the late 19th, early 20th century. And one of the cultural materials at hand was Christianity. But the effort to try to like locate the pure Indian practice was very much at the heart of what white observers of Ute ceremonial practices were doing. Now, there was this really funny moment that I loved reading it and thinking about it in regards to this authenticity. One of the things that happened on the Eastern Utah Ute Indian reservation was Indian agents had this very ambivalent relationship about the dances. Do we allow the sun dances? Do we not allow the sun dances? Do we have the sun dances be held publicly so we can at least keep an eye on them? And it goes back and forth almost from year to year in this sort of very schizophrenic way. But there was one time when the Indian agent decided that he was going to allow the Sundance to happen, but it was going to happen sort of at a county fair type of thing, where he was going to highlight the agricultural products of the Utes and also sort of highlight the availability of the land, because at that point the reservation was still being sold off to white buyers. And he was very proud of himself because he was like, they're doing the Sundance and they know that they're not doing the real Sundance. It's just a performance. And I'm very proud because the religious leaders or the leaders of the tribal leaders of the Utes were patrolling the fairgrounds to make sure no one was drinking alcohol. And this is just all great evidence that my project is working and they're assimilating. And the reason I found this so amusing was that in order for a Sundance to be effective, meaning that the dancers can receive visions, there cannot be alcohol around the dancers. So the tribal leaders were adhering to the prohibition of alcohol that this white guy was thinking was his idea. But they were doing so that the Sundance would be authentic. And it's just sort of this delightful moment of the appearance of Indian agency.
Yeah, and the memorialization kind of aspects, whether it's through kind of what we might consider research, although a lot of this research is questionable because of some of the ethical methods, or in these kind of more fictionalized accounts, is really amazing that you do throughout the book. And one of the kind of more recent events that you look at here is this Meeker Massacre pageant, which happens every year. Can you tell us what's this event all about? What does it tell us about this history? And why do you think it's significant in this Ute land religion narrative you're outlining?
Yeah. So the Meeker Massacre pageant is a reenactment of the battle, the white river agency battle that I talked about earlier. And it's been happening annually since the late 1930s, with a break for a few years because of World War II. And it's held in Meeker, Colorado. It's generally held in conjunction with the Range Call Rodeo, which is one of the largest and longest continual rodeos in Colorado. And it generally happens around the 4th of July. And there are lots of pageants that are going on in that time period of the late 1930s. And this is just another effort of the Meeker Chamber of Commerce to get more tourists to go to Meeker, Colorado, which is a very remote place. There aren't easy highways to get you up there. And so they're trying to draw in tourists. But they're also retelling the story of the Meeker Massacre in ways at different points in time that always emphasize the rightness of the whites gaining ownership over the land. in the 1950s, there is this injection of sort of sorrowfulness in the telling of this story. So that the last scene of the pageant, and this was the case when I saw it in 2009, the end result is that the Utes are kicked off their land, and that as the people who are playing the Utes, who are generally whites dressed in red face, and they're generally the children of Meeker residents, are walking off the stage with their heads like just sort of in this hanging down, full of shame and full of sorrow, and the sense that they're cut off from their land, and as a result, they're cut off from their expression of spirituality. And it's very much in line with the vanishing Indian narrative that if you take Indians away from their ancestral land, then they'll fade away, and they'll just disappear. And earlier iterations of the pageant were very triumphal, like the white people won, hooray, but later iterations were much more emphasizing that connection to the land that the Utes had and just how sad it was that they were no longer here. And it was also inviting the people who were watching the pageant to reflect on how the voices of the Utes might be surrounding us and the landscape in Meeker. So it was like all of these complex ideas about authentic Ute religion wrapped up in tourism and wrapped up in this understanding of particular understanding of place.
Now, you kind of take the book full circle in the kind of final section where you look at the Smoking River powwow, which kind of brings the Utes back into this context and this conversation in kind of more fulsome ways. So what was this intended to accomplish? What took place? How was it received? And how do religion and spirituality fit into the mix with this event?
So in 2007, 2008, and 2009, and 2010, the Forest Service, the Rio Blanco Forest Service, which is has its headquarters in Meeker, and represents the public land that makes up the county where Meeker is, which is around 90% of the county is some sort of public land. One of the The Forest Service had got a new director around this time, and he wanted to know why there weren't Ute employees working for that division of the Forest Service, because the Forest Service has a policy to reach out to the tribes that are historically connected with the regions and employ them, so that there is like sort of this tied to the indigenous peoples that have ancestral ties to the area. And there were two women working in the office at the time, and they were charged with finding out the answer to this question. And one of them happened to be at another event where there was a Ute man there, and she asked him why the Utes didn't come back to Meeker. And he just bluntly said, because we're afraid. And so the Forest Service then was trying to address that that fear to return. And it wasn't simply because of the history of violence that were surrounding the area from the 1879 events, but also because of ongoing issues of racism. And there had definitely been other events where the town had reached out and brought you Indians into the town for things like basketball games, for history talks, and other events. One Ute woman that I interviewed had taken her children to Meeker for a basketball game, and they got called the N-word, as well as other very sort of appallingly racist things. And she just simply didn't want to expose her children to that, which makes perfect sense. And so they started thinking, the Forest Service started thinking about what could possibly bring you Indians back to Meeker. And they landed on the answer of a powwow. So in 2009 and 2010, the U.S. Forest Service, in conjunction with the Meeker Chamber of Commerce and the local history society, sponsored a powwow that was billed as a reconciliation powwow. And Utes helped them plan it and helped organize it and help bring in dancers to the powwow. And it was by the organizer's own definitions, it was successful because it did bring the two communities together. The second powwow included a buffalo dinner that was donated by another Ute tribe. And there was also ceremonies of intentional reconciliation where the descendants of some of the warriors that were responsible for the Meeker incidents stood in the center of the powwow circle, and Meeker residents lined up to give them hugs and shake their hands. And so there were a lot of things that were really intentional about it, but circumscribing it was this idea that it was through Ute spirituality that reconciliation could be had. There were people who were for lovely people who had the best of intentions, but we're talking about the success of the event in terms of the appearance of wildlife, so that the wildlife they believed was blessing the event. There was an appearance of a rainbow that got and interpreted in the sort of sense that the land was speaking and the land was responding to the return of the Utes. Ultimately, the powwow, which was said to is supposed to be an annual powwow, is no longer happening, partly because of a change of leadership. But I also kind of wonder if the over-reliance on ideas about Ute spirituality in order to achieve reconciliation caused the dissolving of it. What if there had been an intentional move to bring Meeker residents to the reservation so that Meeker residents could have a sense of how Utes were living and had been living. So it would have been more of an equal exchange of ideas rather than this sort of ongoing cultural mining of Indian resources in order to serve white aims.
Yeah. Brandy, this is a wonderful book. I'm wondering if you could let us know about some of the things you're working on now before we wrap up the conversation.
Yeah, so I'm really excited about my next project, which is also going to be located in Colorado and going to be building on some of the themes that I address in my first book. But I will be investigating the question of how did Boulder, Colorado become the second most secular city in the United States? Especially when Boulder is, having gone to school there and lived there for 3 years, is definitely full of all sorts of spiritual expressions. And so I'm going to be doing a micro history of the religious landscape of Boulder with an eye towards engaging in the literature on secularism in the United States.
Wow, that sounds fascinating. I can't wait to hear all about that, being a fellow buff. So, well, Brandy, thanks for making the time to talk about this great book, and good luck on your next project.
All right, thank you very much, Christian.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Brandy Dennison about her wonderful new book, Ute Land Religion in the American West, 1879 to 2009, published with the University of Nebraska Press in 2017. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and you've been listening to New Books in Religion.